Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Our guest today is Chad Millman, who is the Vice President, Editorial Director of Domestic Digital Content for ESPN. He was Editor-in-Chief of both ESPN the Magazine and the website for a number of years. He's the author of several books, including The Detonators, The Odds, and he co-authored the New York Times bestseller, They Call Me Baba Booey, with Gary Delabate from The Howard Stern Show. Chad's presiding over this interesting multi-platform project that is on ESPN. It's called We the Fans. It debuts Tuesday, April 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern. And there are going to be 8 episodes in the series, which chronicles a group of Bears season ticket holders in Soldier Field's Section 250. Chad, can you tell me about some of the interesting, like, multi-platform ambitions that you guys have for this project?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks. You know, we had this idea that we wanted to see how fans in a section, longtime season ticket holders, come together as a community, right? I think everybody I've spoken to about this project, when I say we're following the lives of fans in sort of a reality series type way, on and off the field, and it's about the relationships they build with each other and the relationship to the event that they're going to and the emotional and financial investment they make in having a relationship with this team. Every sports fan sort of gets it. They all remember sort of if they had season tickets and sort of the relationships they built with people in their sections. You know, I was telling a buddy the other day about it, and he's like, oh my God, I wanted to have my bar mitzvah in the section of the stadium at Madison Square Garden where we had season tickets for Rangers games. Like, people sort of relate to it. And so it was a really fun project to put together. It was one of those projects here at ESPN where from the beginning, we had good buy-in and participation from all of our content platforms. And it's the kind of thing that ESPN is able to do. You know, it can execute on very large platforms of scale and, you know, create content that can have an impact. And it can create content that is complementary and, not to get too sort of inside baseball, but specific to the platforms that they appear on, right? So it's an 8-episode television series. Each one is 30 minutes, and it's very focused on these characters that we met and sort of did a casting call with during the summer. And, you know, there's a family that has had tickets going all the way back to Wrigley Field. And there are two women who have been friends for 30 years, and they go to the games together. One of the women fought for her tickets in a divorce, to keep her tickets in a divorce. There's a young couple who got married in the middle of the season, and we're with them through the end stages of their wedding planning, through visits with their priest, you know, through their bachelor and bachelorette parties, through the wedding where it's the night the Cubs clinched the NLCS, and there was a lot of drama about whether or not they were going to be allowed to watch the game at the wedding and how the bride was going to feel about that. Like, all these sort of great sort of characters that you develop over the course of a series. But when you go online, you've got a wonderful photo gallery that talks about the origin story for so many people in the section. And it's all something that any sports fan can relate to. It ultimately ends up being a reflection of who we all are as sports fans, and what we all look like today when we are coming from all these disparate backgrounds, but coming together for these seminal moments that involve our team.
You mentioned the financial and emotional investment. It's not cheap to be a season ticket holder in any sport. If you're a Bears season ticket holder and the tickets are $250 a game and you've got 4 of them, that's a 10 grand investment in the season. Given how the Bears have performed the last few years, Is there any hesitance of some of these people to renew their season tickets?
Never. I mean, these people have had tickets for generations, and they go to the game because it's as much about the communal experience. It's as much about the tailgate. It's as much about the planning during the week and how they get excited for the game and how they get excited to be with their friends and with their family to go to the game. And the feeling they have for the Bears, win or lose. I mean, they're in this for the long haul. And this is how they're choosing to spend their money. Everybody can decide, no matter how much money they have, if they have any kind of disposable income, people choose to spend it on all different kinds of things. Some people like to travel. Some people go out for dinner every night. These people are choosing to spend their money on season tickets. And they feel a very rich tradition in being involved in that. And they feel a very rich tradition in their section. It's Section 250, and they all speak about it with pride as if it's their town. One of the interesting things in the series is that ultimately the narrator of all of the episodes is the beer vendor for the section. And we sort of came to that in the middle of planning the episodes because one of the stories, which I don't want to spoil, it became clear how close the beer vendor was with this one person in the section. And then we would hear over and over again about all the characters talking about Terry the beer vendor and how he's been there forever and he's seen them grow up and he's been an important part of their lives. And so, you know, there's a metaphor there for the local bartender who knows everybody in his community and treats sort of that bar as sort of his domain. And so we had him narrate the story, and it makes it feel very warm and personal because he knows these people so well.
You've been in sports media for nearly 25 years now. Have you retained your personal fanhood for Chicago sports teams, or is that something that dissipated when you became a reporter for SI and then later a reporter and editor for ESPN?
First of all, I can't believe you said I've been doing this for almost 25 years, because that's just so upsetting. But no, you kind of don't. You know, the Cubs were in the World Series last year, and I grew up outside Chicago. And by the way, it's just coincidence that we happened to choose the Bears. It was not my suggestion. They just happened to be a team that said yes, and they were the first team that we called. I was in Chicago for the World Series last year, living and dying with every pitch, and anxious that Chapman came in a little bit too early. And, you know, I'm still an avid Bulls fan and still love the Bears. I mean, you can't help but when you work in sports, sort of it changes a little bit. You know, I can't say that as I was watching the Bears season unfold, that because we were doing this series, I was just as happy that it was a train wreck of a season, because that makes for a better narrative. It makes for more drama. It makes for more tension. Like, it's the kind of thing where you want the team to be really, really good or really, really bad. So, you know, my passion isn't as strong as it was when I was 14 years old, and the Bears are in the middle of having the greatest football season in the history of the NFL, and that one loss to the Dolphins killed me, but I'm certainly still a fan.
And do you get a sense that these fans communicate with each other outside of the stadium? Obviously, the people who are married to each other or in the same family with each other do, but do they have any contact, or is the whole relationship kind of centered only on these 8 to 10 interactions a year through their season tickets?
Some do. Some have contact throughout the year, and some of them is entirely centered on these 8 to 10 games that happen over the course of a year, but that also gets people invited to the wedding. Do you know what I mean? And so, those moments are so intense. You're spending time sitting next to somebody for 4 to 5 hours over the course of an afternoon. They're seeing you grow up. They're asking about your dad. You know, over the course of the season, there's one of the characters has health challenges. She has job challenges. There's people in the section trying to help her get a job. And so the relationships are strong. And some people were meeting each other for the first time through the show because they were sitting in different parts of the section. And some of the characters sit right next to each other but aren't family and, you know, became friends because of where they ultimately were sitting for in the section.
Interesting. You mentioned in your first answer about getting the cooperation of all the disparate arms of ESPN, whether that's like TV or digital or the magazine or anything like that. Obviously, you presided over ESPN.com for a while, and I've always been interested in how the planning is done for the story that is front and center on the website, which is really the most, I think, valuable web real estate in sports media, is the story that is the front and center of ESPN.com. How long in advance, if you're doing a feature, is it planned, okay, this is going to be at the front of the website on this day?
I think it's always different. You know, I mean, so much of what we do on the website is about keeping people informed about exactly what's happening in the moment, about the world of sports, that make sure they know and they can have the conversation about it. And, you know, we're lucky in that sports is very scheduled. So most of the time, we know what's coming up. We know what games we want to preview. We know what events are going to matter the most. We know what storylines are going to develop. We know the characters with some semblance of a little bit of time that we want to profile. And so a lot of that is sort of pre-planned. And, you know, we knew we were going to have the Warriors Spurs, right? And so you're going to want to be previewing that and sort of leading up to that. That's the story of the day. But features like this, like We the Fans, or, you know, when Wright Thompson does a big feature, Seth Wickersham and Don Van Atta do a big feature, you know, stuff like that, those stories are often assigned months in advance. And when they come in, we get a good sense of when we're going to want to post them, and we start sort of telling people, you know, throughout the universe that this story is going to post on this day, and we start finding holes for it in the schedule to make sure that as long as there's not breaking news, there's a good opportunity to let it have a long run at the top of the page. But like I said, fortunately, there's a lot of scheduling that happens because there is a sports schedule we can rely on.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but what are a few, I'm not even asking for what's your favorite, but what are some pieces over your tenure as an editor of both the website and the magazine that really stick out to you that you're particularly proud of from over the years?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's so many. That's a really good question. You know, years ago, Chris Jones, who's one of our contributors for a long time, he wrote this amazing, amazing story about a Japanese baseball pitcher who just works and works and works and works over the course of a long tournament, and sort of the impact that has on this guy who, you know, everyone thinks can be the great next Japanese import, and he should be saving his arm and not working so hard and not throwing, you know, 800 pitches over the course of 4 days at a high school baseball tournament. But he does it for pride and tradition and wouldn't even think twice about what the long-term damage would be. Wright Thompson has written some wonderful stories. You know, one of the stories that I love more than any is a couple years ago, he did a 25,000, 30,000-word story about the city of New Orleans 10 years after Katrina that we turned into an entire issue of the magazine, which I thought was just outstanding. And it was sort of a tour de force in reporting and storytelling and understanding how sports can influence a society, both in ways good and bad, and help with the recovery, but also impede progress. And I just thought that was amazing. You know, I mentioned Seth and Don before. They have been doing phenomenal work about sort of power in the NFL and how owners use it and wield it, and how Roger Goodell wields it. I think those stories are amazing. Mark Schlabaugh and Paul Levine did phenomenal work last year on Baylor and sort of the history of the university covering up and ignoring sexual assault. And, you know, that changed, you know, the administration at Baylor and changed a lot the way a lot of things are done at the university. So, you know, it runs such a gamut. You can go from big investigative things to heavy feature things, and then just sort of some of the developments we do that are really smart for sports fans. And so they are small, compact, cool items that you see in the feed that sort of speak to the conversation, that aren't going to resonate for as long, but in that moment, they're everything you need as a sports fan. And part of sort of the importance of ESPN from a digital perspective is providing that kind of in-the-moment context and conversation. And so those are things that are sort of that I'm certainly as proud of as anything else that takes months and months to gestate.
Right. The sports media, it's an interesting combination of ephemera and these deep features. And there's our editor, Jason McIntyre, uses an analogy like, as a website, you need your vegetables and you need your junk food, because you need the junk food and the churn to make it so that people have something to keep coming back to every half hour, hour throughout the day. And you want these features as at anchors to leave lasting impressions. How do you decide what the optimal ratio is in, let's say, above the fold on ESPN.com of like these deeply rich reported features versus the current news cycle versus maybe things like mock drafts or fantasy that isn't really edifying, but is very interesting to the consumer?
Well, I would argue that it's not, that if it's interesting to the consumer, then it's edifying, because that's what our purpose is to serve the users of the website. And so if that's what they're showing they're interested in, then one of our responsibilities is to provide it. And without sort of speaking to the lowest common denominator, but to be understanding that people want to know what Mel Kiper and Todd McShay have to say. Like, the run-up to the draft is hugely interesting to people. And to understand, you know, it actually goes back to the beginning on the conversation about sort of the passion people have for their teams and the passion fans have to be connected to that culture. They want to know who they're going to be rooting for in the fall. They want to know, they think they know where the holes are on their teams, and they want to know sort of what the conversation is. And in to capture that comes in all shapes and sizes. And you'll see on our website, when you go to the front page, you're going to see some stories that link into deeper reporting. You're going to see a lot of videos, and you're going to see these sort of smaller nuggets that are three or four lines that you can just read directly on your screen. Those are all immensely important and immensely edifying, and they allow people to sort of get context around what's happening in the world that makes them feel connected to either the sport they love, the team they love, or the conversation that's happening. So I don't disagree. There's sort of the vegetables and the dessert.
But I didn't mean to say that they weren't edifying as an insult, because if you look at the big lead, there's lots of things that we do that I wouldn't qualify as edifying, but I would say are important for serving the readership that we have. I just mean that it's not the same like richly reported feature of like a Wright Thompson or a Chris Jones.
Sure, but I think that's a I don't know that those are hugely important, and we love doing them. And certainly, you know, over the course of my history, it's been some of the stuff that has been that I've been most passionate about and most interested in. And I think that it's sort of there's room for everyone at the table. And I'm not indicating that you're not saying that, but I don't think that everybody needs that at every second of the day, and so you need to provide a lot of different things. And in this case, I don't know, you know, in sort of a vegetable and dessert analogy, I don't know which would be which. I don't know if, like, you know, a mock draft is vegetable and a long-form feature is dessert or vice versa. I'm thinking about it much more as in what do people need in the moment, and then what can ESPN provide that nobody else can by virtue of our resources and our sensibility and the access and the insight and, you know, the storytelling we can provide.
That's a reasonable answer.
Storytelling, by the way, occurs in all shapes and sizes. It occurs as photographs. It occurs as video. It occurs as sort of those short form items that you don't even need to click into. And then it occurs as sort of the most sort of gloriously reported pieces.
You mentioned some of these writers like Wright Thompson, Seth Wickersham, Chris Jones. As you look at the landscape now, either within ESPN or outside of it, who are some people who you feel like are under the age of 35 or 40 who might be one day held up as these extraordinary magazine feature writers?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. You know, without giving away ages, like, I'm just thinking about, we have so many people on in our group who are amazing right now. I'm actually loath to mention anybody because if I start mentioning people, then I start leaving people out. But I think there's so much talent in our group that we're not going to be lacking anybody being able to write huge features for us in any way, whether it's on the website or in the magazine for a very long time.
That was a diplomatic answer. So
I try, man.
Moving on from that,
I appreciate you letting me off the hook.
Well, you're not going to like, follow listen, up. It's just going to annoy you. I don't think
I'm already not going to hear the end of it. That I happen to think of like Wright and Seth and Don before I thought of, you know, something else.
I think you'll skate by. It was deep enough in that we'll see. Right. But I wanted to talk a little bit about gambling with you because that was a beat that you covered really extensively as a reporter, and you created the chalk section at ESPN.com. I know the NFL has meddled with ESPN's coverage of things in the past, and I was wondering if either directly or indirectly you heard anything from the league about how they felt about your devoting an entire vertical to gambling.
Well, I'd probably quibble with your lead-in to the question about the NFL meddling with coverage, because whether it's gambling or not, I've never sort of gotten any feedback from NFL or anyone else about coverage. So the short answer is no, I've never heard word one from the NFL about sort of the way we cover gambling.
The Las Vegas Raiders is going to be an interesting story because there was some question before about whether the league would want the books to take off the Raiders games off the board or might even want to prohibit Super Bowl gambling in the event that either the Raiders are in the game or the game in Las Vegas. With your experience reporting on sports books, that would be a totally untenable request, right?
That would be massively difficult to manage. You know, the Super Bowl, obviously everybody knows how big the Super Bowl is. It is the premier financial event for sports books in the state of Nevada. The handle is only getting bigger every single year. And you could never do anything. They would never be able to accept any regulations that diminishes the power of that event. And downstream from that is anything that diminishes the power of the NFL season. And if you're saying you can't, you know, bet on Raiders games, then you're essentially taking 1/16th of the action off the board for many weekends and a higher percentage for the weekends when there are buys and several teams aren't playing. So that's just too much money. It's too much money for the state of Nevada that they're then incumbent upon making up in other ways by bringing in an NFL team, which, you know, there's a lot of projections about what it'll cost, but you just never know about what they'll make, but you just never know. And so you don't want to give away guaranteed revenue that is only growing. And I can't imagine that ever would have been something that they agreed to.
When I was reading your bio to research for this podcast, it said that in 1998, you left the magazine to write the odds about a trio of Vegas bookmakers and wise guys and a search for lucrative opportunities during the height of the internet boom before returning to ESPN as a contributing editor in 2001. Are there any interesting, like, failed startup ideas or something that you did in the internet boom that isn't specified in that bio?
No, there were two things. There were two things. One was there was a company called, I always laugh about this. There was a company called Deja.com that, you know, this was in, you know, like it says, sort of the age of the internet boom, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s. Deja.com had been a very popular sort of cult discussion thread website based in Austin, Texas, which, you know, at the time, along with Seattle, was really where there was a lot of action in the nascent web world. The smart idea that they were going to take Deja.com, put a lot of venture and investment money behind it, and turn it into a real business by making magazines out of all the content that was being created by users. And so they hired me and to do that and to come in and make a sports magazine out of some of the sports conversations. And they decided they were moving the company from Austin to New York. And they got these new offices like on Fifth Avenue in New York. And I was going to do the magazine, and it was the perfect timing because I left ESPN to go work on this book about guys who bet on sports for a living. And I couldn't have stayed at ESPN and done it. Like it was untenable from a time perspective. I needed to be gone so much. And Deja was willing, like after I'd started the book, Deja was willing to give me the time I needed to travel to Vegas for 2 weeks at a time and every other weekend and be gone for all of March and all these sort of, all these concessions they would make. So I go to Deja and I'm thinking, all right, I've got all these options and I'm going to get rich and it's going to be amazing. And then I'm going to write this book and the book is going to be amazing. And then I'm just going to, I'm going to be, you know, 30 years old and I'm going to retire. And
that's a good so plan.
Of course, yeah. Of course, like Deja.com, 2 weeks into it, they decide that the business model of making magazines out of discussion sites isn't going to work. And they completely revamp their business model into something that is selling products and having links to those products from the website and also allowing users to write opinions about the webs about the products that help sell them. So all of a sudden I went from running the sports magazine to being responsible for the home department and the sporting goods department. And my wife is an architect. And to this day, I've never told her exactly what I was doing because I knew so much about sort of home products that she would come home and like talk about a renovation she's working on and the certain refrigerators that the clients wanted. And I would know exactly what she was talking about and I'd be able to say something and she'd look at me and be like, I don't even know who you are anymore. And eventually the company went under right around the time that it didn't go under. I think it got like – it scaled down to the point where there was nobody left working there, and then it got sold for a minimal amount to I don't even know who. My options were worthless. I kept wondering when they were going to – like, they kept laying people off, and they never laid me off, and I wasn't even coming to work anymore. And then finally, like, they just laid everybody off, and I went back to ESPN the magazine. Like, at that time, like, they brought me back as a contributor, and then, like, a year or two later – I went back as an editor in the NFL department, which is what I had left as, you know, 2 years earlier.
I feel like
that. At that point, the book came out. And I had also started with a buddy, a playground basketball website called iHoops.com. Hmm. And we had the video rights to these different, like, playground games all over the country. Like, we had the video rights to the Cage on West 4th Street. And we had the video rights to Tillery Park in Brooklyn, like the organizers of the tournaments, and to another event out in Chicago. And so, like, we had all this cool playground basketball video, but, like, I think we were just, you know, the loads weren't great. The technology wasn't great. It was hard to manage it all. I went back to ESPN, and, you know, we sold it off for a very small amount of money to the point where I think we both still ended up losing money.
Hmm. But it's nice to have like ESPN as like a place to go back to after those things didn't pan out.
Yeah, but that was just lucky. Like they just happened to need somebody. And so, you know, sometimes you just get lucky.
Is there anything that we didn't talk about either about We the Fans or ESPN.com and the magazine or gambling or your general life that you think is really interesting and you want to talk about on this platform right now?
I can't say there's anything about my life that would be generally interesting that is worthy of this platform.
Thank you very much, Chad. We really appreciate your time. Hope to speak with you again sometime down the road. Best of luck as everything comes together with We the Fans. I'm definitely excited to watch it as somebody who lives in Chicago and roots for a different NFC North team, but I think it'll be a pretty interesting project, and it'll be cool to see how it pans out.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate the time.
Have a great rest of the week.
You too.
Turn stranger.